Hello, friends and neighbors. This is Bob Tomlin, sitting in my ham shack here, as we did about 1 year ago, and right next to me,
Bob Zanotti. Bob, we were really surprised how popular the two Bobs topic on Switzerland in Sound became. So after our session in 2004, philosophizing, looking back and looking forward and being a bit critical there about radio and so on, we said, well, why don't we do what we used to do and sit down together and talk about the technical aspects of radio. We'll be looking, for example, into choosing a receiver, what to look for, important features, portables versus desktops, or even transceivers. Some people might want to buy a ham radio transceiver thinking that's the way to go. What's the best antenna? The fundamentals, the types, antennas for limited space, and a few tricks of using an antenna. The causes of noise, or what we call in ham radio QRN, QR November. Where does it come from? This can really ruin your listening at home. How to track it down and do something about it. Fighting interference on the air from other stations. The fundamentals of propagation and sunspots and so on. Hearing stations beamed outside your area. And maybe we could look a little bit at digital broadcasting, which is not here yet in a big way, but some people say it's the way of the future. Anyway, Bob, first of all, why don't we get very basic here and first of all describe how shortwave broadcasting or HF broadcasting works. For example, so-called propagation. How do radio waves using shortwave or HF, how does a signal in Bern, Switzerland get to New York or get to Sydney, Australia? What happens to that signal?
When you look at the radio station transmitting, take it for instance, a 20-21 megahertz frequency, we distinguish between a ground wave and a sky wave.
Now, the ground wave would be, for example, what the local AM or standard broadcast medium wave station uses, or long wave stations, the wave that goes along the ground.
But which is rather quickly attenuated, and then it fades off.
In the case of short wave.
In the wave.
In long wave, medium wave, it goes quite a distance, but short wave, it fades off very quickly.
Yes, and this is due to daylight absorption propagation, or also by many of the earth, you know, the surface, the woods, the hills, the mountains, you name them all. But what interests us actually is the sky wave, which goes up depending on what kind of an antenna the transmitting station is using. For faraway stations, they have it is beneficial to radiate the sky wave at a very flat angle. And this goes up. It doesn't get lost into space, but when it hits a certain layers, the so-called propagation layers,
the ionosphere,
layer. We name them the D layer, the E, the E1, the
E. They have letters of the alphabet.
They have we have, and what when it comes to DXing and far away reflection, we call the F1 and the F2 layers.
These are the high layers,
Or the highest ones, you see?
Yeah.
And
so in other words, the transmitter is really beaming in all directions. It does transmit a ground wave, but that's not useful or really very important for HF or shortwave long-distance communication. What you want to do is you get that radiation which continues up into the sky, hits the ionosphere, and is bounced down again, right? I mean, it's you can imagine the ionosphere being like a ceiling of a room, and you take a rubber ball or something, and you throw it up, it bounces, hits the ceiling, and bounces back to Earth at the same angle.
Well, not quite exactly, because we don't use, actually, the term reflection. A better name, the correct word, would be a refraction.
Yeah, yeah. Now you're getting really technical.
We'll get technical.
But that's, you know, if you visualize the ball hitting the ceiling and bouncing back, that's pretty much what happens to the signal.
Yeah. Well, the difference between the reflection and refraction is very simple. Reflecting is being reflected at the same angle it comes in.
Yeah.
In, out, the same angle. And refraction, this may mean that the wave goes up, it may even follow the ionized layers for a certain
for a while,
and then it comes down.
Then it comes down, yeah.
And we have,
but it eventually comes down.
It comes down, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it doesn't come down again, we have very poor propagation. What we have actually at now in the summer of 2005. But another item of interest, Bob, is you know as well as I do, we have a phenomenon between where the ground wave ends and the first sky wave comes down.
That's the so-called dead zone.
That's the dead zone. Or the escape,
you don't hear anything there.
The escape zone. And this may happen if somebody, for instance, let's take it, as an example, if you have a station here in Switzerland, when we had Schwarzenberg, we were able to listen to the ground wave, even in Bern, but a little bit further, like Lucerne, the ground wave has gone, and the sky wave was not yet appearing. So they didn't hear that station at all.
Yeah. And of course on short wave, except in certain certain designs, antenna designs, where you deliberately don't want a dead zone, you can design an antenna so that it there is practically no dead zone. The sky wave begins right at the transmitter, because the wave goes straight up and then down. This is desirable sometimes, but basically for long distance work, like this example of we do it every day in ham radio. I talk to my friends back in New Jersey every day, and for that you want that low angle radiation. You don't care if you have a dead zone around the transmitter, because you're not really interested in in talking to people, you know, close by. You'd use other frequencies for that. But if you're on the 14 megahertz, the 20 meter band, or 15 meters, 21 megahertz, which is also close to broadcast bands being 15 megahertz, 21 megahertz is the 13 meter band, for example, for broadcasting. There you want to get a low angle, because you have this horizon business. The lower the angle, without being attenuated by the Earth itself, if you can get just slide in right over the horizon, straight out, obviously
5 to 10 degrees.
Yeah, your refraction is going to be farther away than, you know, if you have a vertical signal, it's going to come down right on top of you again.
Well, and this determines, of course, the amount of hops between the ionosphere. And when it comes down, it hits the Earth again, being reflected again or refracted again from the Earth.
Bounced back
and,
up again.
Such in way of a zigzag way between Earth's surface and the ionosphere.
And each time you hit the Earth and go back, or, you know, each reflection or refraction will decrease the strength of the signal. So that's why you want as few hops as possible.
Depending on the electric property of the Earth, if we are lucky and we hit the ocean, the salt water is a very good reflector in it. So we lose little signal there, but of course deserts and things like that would absorb much more of the short wave. But an item, Bob, when we are talking about this flat angle radiation, of course this brings us directly to our own location where we are living. If you are living, as you do, Bob, almost on a hilltop, you have a clear shot all around to the horizon. You have no problems about obstacles which stand in your way, as I do.
Yeah.
Right behind my house, you know, I have this hill, which I can overlook it at an angle of 20-25 degrees. But still, this is too steep, and I have problems to reaching, for instance, the United States.
You go the long path the other way around.
the problem is, if you have a California or one in the West Coast there, tell them to swing the beam around, and they say, why? Mm-hmm. You have to explain that. Anyway, I can hear some of the newcomers there and say, you're talking about ionospheric layers. How come? How are these layers produced? Are they there day and night, the same intensity, the same strength? Well, the answer is very simple. These gas layers, which are around our Earth, our globe, are being radiated by the sun. The solar rays, and particularly the ultraviolet rays, have the property to, as the name says, ionize these gas layers, meaning they kick out electrons, gas electrons out of it, And then, of course...
Oh, that's a ham radio relay beeping in the background.
Yeah. They will keep it on. And, of course, these ionized layers, gas molecules, which are lacking electrons, become electrically conductible.
They get whipped up by the sun.
Yes,
they get all excited.
And that's, and that has, they have the property to refract short waves depending on its wavelength.
They become like a mirror.
Well, it's
to keep it simple, I mean, yeah.
That's right. If the solar radiation is very strong at solar maximums, we have thicker layers. We have better reflections.
That's why signals are stronger, and you get much better propagation, much better signals.
Yeah, right. And right now we have poor propagation. Yeah. The layers are very thin, and they refract only a portion of the short waves, and this accounts for the poor propagation or reception we have at the moment.
During high propagation periods, you can use higher and higher frequencies and much less power to do the job. We know this in amateur radio. But when the sunspots go down and propagation is not good, the signals are not propagated as well, you might find whole bands that are just dead, unusable, and you have to go very low in frequency. But this is an 11-year cycle, and hopefully we're going to be getting out of this minimum soon, and we can start looking for better times. But let's assume that wherever you are, even in the bad periods, I mean, broadcasters make a big effort to supply signals even during bad periods, so there are signals there to hear. Let's assume average conditions. To pick up these signals, Bob, obviously you need a receiver, but unlike some other bands, the antenna plays a very important role to good or the best possible shortwave reception. What is the best antenna?
It's about the same as if you would ask me which is the best car. So let's modify the expression best by good.
Yeah. What will do the best, you know, an adequate job anyway?
A good job, because there is no, in simple terms, the best antenna. In addition, it plays a role, whatever possibilities you have to set up such an antenna. But, of course, an antenna, would we know?
It's got to be a conductive material. That's number one.
That's right. And an antenna is the best high-frequency amplifier, let's put it like that.
Yeah, your receiver starts with the antenna.
Yeah, if you can't put the signal into your receivers, the result will be nil.
You can have the world's best receiver, but if there's no antenna connected to it, you're not going to hear a thing.
So a good antenna is an antenna which you can erect outside the house, as far as possible, from the walls, the building, and neighbors, because first of all, to avoid man-made noises by all the electrical appliances we have today.
We'll be getting into that, but there's so much junk in the houses these days, computers, fax machines, digital displays, you name it.
So the reason is to put an antenna, if you can, the possibility, outside the house as high as possible, and then to bring the signal in by a shielded cable.
So-called coaxial cable.
Coax cable. And what helps underneath is when you have a provision to put this piece of wire to resonate on the wanted frequency.
Okay, now we're using some technical terms here that, let's start with the simplest of antennas. Somebody just strings, they still sell these kits, but you don't have to buy a kit. You can just take a roll of wire, maybe 75 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet, and you string it between two trees, and you bring it into the shack, at best with a coaxial cable. If you're lucky enough to have a shack, and that is a place where you're listening, that doesn't have a lot of noisy gadgets and things, and you might try it without a shielded lead-in wire. But if you're finding a lot of noise, you want to shield that with coaxial cable. We'll get into this later about QRN or static and other noise, and QRM, which is man-made noise that comes in. But that's the simplest kind of antenna. Will that so-called long wire or just a piece of wire like that do a good job with the average equipment?
It will do a good job. It will do even a better job, I mentioned it, if you put it to resonate and by an antenna coupler.
Well, that's a so-called tuned antenna. Okay. That's another category. Yeah. The one is the simplest thing. You throw out some wire and bring it in, connect it to your receiver. You'll pick something up reasonably well if you have a halfway decent receiver. But why is it important for the best results to have a so-called tuned antenna? What's the magic there?
The magic is very simple physics facts and figures there. If you have a wire, a conductor, which you put to resonate on the wanted frequency, you benefit from a maximum power transfer.
And here we use the term wavelength. People have very often heard, what wavelength are you tuned to? In other words, a frequency corresponds to the length of the actual wave. And this is measured in meters and centimeters, right?
Yeah. Well, take the figure 300 divided by the meters, you get the amount in megahertz. So a 20-meter frequency corresponds to 15 megahertz.
Let's maybe take it this way. For those who have a limited amount of space, they can just put up a piece of wire and they can't really cut it for any particular frequency. They just have a so-called random length of wire. What does the antenna tuner do? It's an actual unit that you have down by your receiver, and you can make the antenna resonate on different frequencies. How does that work? It's a trick, does it work?
It's very simple. An antenna tuner consists of a number of coils, which represents the so-called inductivity, and you have the capacitor, also the capacity, and you have the possibility, a given length of wire, to lengthen it and to bring it near to the length of a odd quarter wavelength of the wanted frequency.
So you can electrically change the length of the antenna.
Right.
So in a way, you're fooling physics a little bit. You can never fool physics 100%, but you're electrically sort of compensating for the fact that you don't have the exact perfect physical length of the antenna.
That's right. It's a compromise.
Yeah. They work, though, don't they?
But they work. All
they
right.
work.
Do you remember, I think again of the apartment dwellers, do you remember, Bob, there was, 20, 30 years ago, we were talking high and low about this British joystick antenna. You remember that?
The joystick is one of the popular ones of the past, yes. Yeah.
And it was basically what? It was a rod, a vertical rod.
A piece of doweling, like a wooden rod or a plastic rod or something.
I think it was a plastic rod that just wound up with a certain length of wire.
Yeah. A coiled antenna.
Antenna.
Which was physically long, but of course made compact because of the helical winding.
That's right. But the meat about it was actually they had an antenna coupler to go with it.
Yeah.
And they put the end of that wired helical coil to the antenna tuner, and from then on they put into the receiver, and the listener had the possibility to twiddle the knobs there until he found the signal strength come up. So it was funny how popular this joystick was. I don't know if it's still being sold. I don't know.
I haven't seen them around, or I haven't heard them talked about for a long time.
But it is a possibility, of course. If you haven't got any means of putting an outside antenna, you can put such a rod. It could be a glass fiber rod or something. You can wind it with a certain numbers of turns, of coils, copper wire.
This is an antenna for very limited space.
Yes,
just stick it out the window or something.
The most limited thing is to use the receiver's extractable whip, which you have.
Yeah.
Portable.
Well, that's the other thing that we'll get into in a moment, but I mean, we can spend that's more on the question of receivers these days, but I will say this, that most of the modern receivers are so sensitive, they're so well designed with modern technology, that as a rule, you can get very, very good results with even the relatively small built-in whips, provided, of course, you're not in some steel and concrete apartment building, which most people, unfortunately, are, because it is like a Faraday cage. In other words, none of the signal gets in.
Yeah.
I mean, what you can do is go to a window where some signals do get in. But again, the best thing is to have an outdoor antenna of some type.
Yeah, well, use your imagination and your fantasy a little bit. We were talking also in our ways about the so-called windowsill antenna, and this was nothing that could have been kind of a fishing rod with a wire on it. All sorts of...
That's been done, too. That was one of your ideas years ago, especially if you're in a place where they don't want any antennas at all. You can use all but so-called invisible antennas. Just take a very, very... You don't need to conduct a lot of energy. You just take, a very fine wire and coil it up on a fishing rod, okay. Put a weight on the end of it, and just let it down at night, so nobody can even see it. You can even let it hang down a building or something. Nobody's ever going to see it. Or there's the flagpole antenna, where if they don't allow outdoor antennas, especially here in the UK, this is a big problem over there especially, you can put just a fine wire up a flagpole. And, just bury the lead in underground. You can do it that way. So there are all kinds of ways, and then have an antenna tuner on there, and that'll maximize the signal coming in. But, Bob, what about so-called tuned antennas? These are antennas which are actually cut for a particular frequency. What kind of antennas are they? What are the basic designs for those? For example, we take this 20-meter amateur band, yeah, or 19-meter broadcast band, 15 megahertz. Does that mean the antenna should be 19 meters long?
Not necessarily. A lot of these tuned antennas are trapped in a way. Let's take, for instance, our case. You and I, we're both using so-called three-element beam antennas.
These are directional antennas.
Yes, and they are tuned for three bands, 10, 15, and 20 meters in the amateur band. And the length are being separated because the radiator had to take care of all the three frequencies, and they had to be electrically separated by coils, so-called traps.
And
separate the frequencies, yes. And since we are using dipoles antenna, two-poles antenna, then, of course, we had two traps each side for each element, you see. Anyway, these are amateur antennas tuned for certain bands.
And they will do a reasonably good job for example, 19 meters and the 13-meter broadcast bands. They're pretty close. There'll be a bit of a mismatch, but they'll do a better job than just a piece of wire.
Yeah, well, the band, if the traps are properly cut and adjusted, you will have very good resonance properties on these bands.
But Bob, those are antennas that are small and compact, because the higher you go in frequency, the shorter the wavelength, and therefore the shorter the antennas become. But what about some of the other popular bands, like, for example, the 80-meter band or 75-meter broadcast band, 3 megahertz, 3.9 up in there. Then you also have the 40-meter band. These are getting big, and it's not practical for most people to have directional antennas there. So what is the best kind of a tuned antenna for those low bands where you need longer wires?
Yeah, well, our three-element beams we have, Bob, we make them rotatable, and this has the advantage that you can turn it into the direction you want to work.
And there's also, again, there's an amplification factor, like a beam of a headlight. Yeah. This is true. But, I mean, we're talking about the low bands where you can't have a rotating array.
So, for instance, what I have for 80 and 40 meters is simply a long wire, which at the end has got an automatic antenna coupler.
So we're back to in ham radio we say a coupler or an antenna tuner in receiving. Same idea. Same thing. Because hams also you can transmit.
Yeah.
If you have a heavily constructed tuner, you can actually transmit on these frequencies as well.
You can also have either single or twin dipole antennas, which contain traps for the appropriate also receiving bands. You can have that. It's on the market. Mm-hmm. Multi-band antenna, and there are small traps in between, and they are normally built as dipoles, and you can feed in by, what we said before, a coax cable.
Yeah.
But here again, the most important thing is that you have two poles or two flag poles between which, or trees between which you can put
and Eric Duran. Trees are a ham's and shortwave listener's best friend. Very, very cheap towers.
Yeah.
But Bob, what about, there's an antenna type which is a classic. It's considered the basic cut antenna, tuned in the sense that it's tuned because it's cut for the right frequency, and that's a dipole. Now, what is a dipole and what is the basic approach to building one?
The simplest way to build a dipole is you use a normal twin lead power cable, a plastic one.
Oh, like they call it zip cord sometimes.
It's a
typical old lamp cord,
right?
Made of plastic insulation, two parallel conductors, yeah. And if you cut it in the middle, the insulation, of course, not the wire.
You can
rip it. Yeah.
Yeah, and
rip it apart.
Yeah, and then make sure you have
or loudspeaker cable. Very simple too.
Yeah. It should be have some physical strength if you have a storm
or wind
something,
or something.
It doesn't come down like
right.
That. But make sure that you have enough space at the end to clamp in a porcelain egg. Or an insulator in one way or another.
Yeah.
And then you rip it off until you have the overall half wave length of your wanted preferred band.
So in other words, let's take the classic amateur band. This applies to all of them, whether it's 20 meters amateur or 19 meters broadcast band or 13 meters or 40 meters. Or 40 meters, let's go down there because that's where most people are using these wires. A 40-meter dipole is very simple. The overall length is 20 meters. Half
twice
of the wavelength.
Twice 10 meters each side.
Two times 10 together will give you 20. Yeah. There are two poles, in other words. Each side of the antenna, or leg as they call it, has to be 10 meters, and together it's 20. And so you stop ripping the cord when you have a 20 meters overall.
Right. Yeah.
Or, I mean, if you want to take ordinary copper wire, you just cut two pieces.
Exactly.
10 meters each, 33 feet, put it together, and you have a half-wave dipole on 40 meters. That's it.
The zip cord,
and then you have the parallel.
Yeah.
You can feed it with the same cord.
That's the advantage.
Yeah, if you're using the rip cord, the zip cord, yeah.
Just make sure that when it ends, you fix in the center, as not as, you know, rip it off more than necessary.
You can put a few turns of tape or something on there or
make
tie it or something.
Make a knot in it or some way.
So it won't continue to rip.
Right. And with the rest of the zip cord, you run into your house, into your receiver. And that's a fairly good antenna setup.
All right. So we have basic antenna technology here in the theory. So we're getting the best signal we can from the outside, and we're delivering it to a receiver. And now, Bob, the big question is...
not again.
What is the best receiver? Let me answer part of it, Bob. The non-technical part of it. Basically, you have to ask yourself, what is going to be my main use of this receiver?
Yeah, exactly.
Am I going to travel with it? Do I want it ultra-compact? You want it to fit into your pocket? Do you want it to fit into at least a suitcase or a bag or something like this, an overnight bag? This is a so-called portable receiver, and they do very, very good jobs. They perform quite well these days, the modern designs, and they're very compact. I can mention a couple of them here, some standard favorites, and a new one that I've come in contact with. Then, of course, on the other hand, if you want to do this in a very serious way, you want more what they say today is the bells and whistles. All of the more gadgets and the knobs and special features like notch filters and bandpass tuning and all of this. Then you start getting into the larger so-called desktop receivers. But let's look at the portables first, Bob. You've had many portable receivers, and I have a feeling these are probably the most popular because of their portability, their mobility. What are the basic things to look for in a receiver? A good portable receiver.
I mean, the main features you mentioned yourself, Bob, it's portability. But you will find a lot of them on the market and at reasonable prices, say. It's normally way beyond below $100 or so. But still, you say they are excellent.
Well, they're good.
They perform well. It's about the same as if you want to compete with a Fiat 500 against a Formula One race car. It's a brutal.
There have to be some differences in there.
Right. But as we say, what are the aims?
We're talking about people who want to hear the news. They want to keep up. They maybe want to hear some of the leading stations, the Voice of America, the BBC World Service. I mean, these are powerhouses with relay stations and everything else, and they're putting out pretty good signals. Nothing exotic, just standard popular radio stations.
Would it be unfair to call them the sort of the garden variety of regimes?
Well, some people might take offense at that, but let's say the simple, everyday, popular-priced receiver. That's what we're talking about.
But now we have the other group of forthcoming future amateurs. They would like to be able to listen to single sideband.
Well, wait a minute. We have to explain what single sideband is first. It's a mode of transmission. Which is used in communications, especially by radio amateurs and some point-to-point services. You're holding your nose and talking. That's because the so-called carrier wave, which goes along with amplitude modulation, has been removed. Also one of the sidebands, so that nothing is transmitted but the intelligence, as we call that. And this is used almost exclusively in amateur radio work. Bob, why don't you tune in some of it? Can you tune it in? Maybe just go on the ham band there.
Oh, yeah.
You can do that. You got a fancy transceiver there. Well, that's code. That's something else. Now, that's a single sideband station listening on an ordinary AM radio. All right. This is the way single sideband sounds in an AM receiver. Now apply the so-called product detector, which makes it possible to decode, to demodulate the sideband, and it's as clear as a bell.
Yeah, because you said the information, the music, or the words are actually contained in the sideband. In AM, automatically, by modulating a carrier, two sidebands are produced. Only one is actually needed. And this is the advantage. I mean, the power which goes into the carrier and into the second sideband, which is not necessary, actually. If you leave that, you put all the power available into only the information carrier, that sideband. All you have to do at the receiving side is to reproduce a carrier which demodulates the sideband.
But we have to point out, you're not going to hear this in broadcasting. It's a dream which will never come true. Broadcasting is not going to use single sideband. But if you want to listen to radio hams, you're going to have a receiver that's capable of receiving SSB, single sideband. But there's another use for a sideband capable receiver, Bob. How about tuning in just one of the, like Bettermünster, the German Swiss, or some other station there, which is transmitting in AM. For example, maybe the French Swiss on, what are they, 765? Because I think 531 Bettermünster transmits only music, which is not a good. Yeah, that's. All right. Okay, this is.
In AM.
531. In AM.
But now I can also receive a station, an AM, using only the sideband.
You've got a good sideband receiver, you can. There, now it's being received in sideband.
And this is upper sideband?
Or
now
lower.
I can switch to the.
Exactly. Two sidebands. There's one above the carrier frequency and one below. And this is important because if you, and this is getting into the subject of QR mic, as we call it, or interference from another radio station. Let's say there's a radio station on the low end, or the low side of the station you want to hear interfering. So what you can do with so-called selectable sideband reception is to go to the upper sideband, which is clear and clean, and listen to the sideband clear as a bell. So that's why SSB is a very important feature, not only for receiving hams, but also allowing you to switch the better of the two sidebands in a situation where you have some interference.
And the good receiver will also offer you a little bit a variety of the sideband, the feature. It's called the sync. The synchronous
detector, right.
And here it is very simple. When you tune to a station, you can slightly tune the main tuner, maybe 1 kc kilocycles up or down, and automatically, electronically, the receiver will switch to the upper or the lower sideband, and hence cut the QRM or the interference from a neighboring station away.
It's a very handy, and it works like a miracle. Sometimes, you know, we would have to search around here to demonstrate that, and we don't have the time right now to do it. But we've all heard these problems. You know, you're trying to listen to a station, especially a DX or distance station, not coming in very well, and all the serious DXers, these are the people who make a hobby out of receiving distance signals, or serious shortwave listeners who actually want to hear stations from a distant country, they have to have this selectable sideband very often, or else you cannot pull the station through. And unfortunately, with fewer and fewer stations on the air these days, and fewer local relays that provide signals to your particular part of the world, this is especially in North America, for example, they're losing relays there right and left. The BBC is not really serving North America deliberately anymore, so you have to look for stations, for signals for these stations coming from other parts of the world. So you need all the help you can get. Good antenna, you need selectable sideband capability, for example. And there we're getting into the desktop receivers, which do a good job. But before we do that, Bob, I was at Culpsville, Pennsylvania, for the annual get-together of shortwave listeners, and a few broadcasters turn up. I try to get there every year. It's north of Philadelphia. It's so much fun, Bob. I keep trying to get you to come along one day. That would be, I think you'd enjoy yourself. And the one thing this year, I won something. I bought some raffle tickets. And they had a lot of really good receivers that they were giving away. I mean, some fantastic prizes. And I was very lucky enough. I didn't bring either of them here. I ran out of the house so fast I should have brought one. But the one I'd like to mention that I won in the raffle is a Kaito or Kaito, K-A-I-T-O, K-A-1103. Now, you were talking about receivers that didn't cost much money before, Bob. I mean, these days, $100 will not buy you too much. You know, a couple of people go to a restaurant meal in the wrong place, and the $100 is gone like nothing. Mm-hmm. And I have seen this. This thing was donated by a company called Radios for You, R-A-D-I-O-S, the number 4, YOU.com, Radios for You, written together .com. They were kind enough to donate quite a few nice prizes there, really nice stuff. And they're on the internet. You can get this radio from them, this Kaito 1103. Universal Radio is another big address to go to, universal-radio.com. There are others. And I also like to mention Monitoring Times, which is probably the leading regular monthly publication devoted to shortwave and HF and amateur and scanning and all this sort of thing. Monitoring Times, check them on the internet. You can subscribe to it, an excellent publication, and they have lots and lots of advertisements for all the modern technology receivers. Radio Netherlands still features some of the older surveys have they done of equipment. The Passport to World Band Radio. Larry Magny, I saw him in Culpsville as well this year. And he's still doing a terrific job with receiver technology. There are a lot of internet resources and publications. If you do some work, anyone listening to us knows how to use the internet. So do a little work looking up these shortwave receiver surveys and things. There's a lot of material out there.
And one thing I would like to add, Bob. I was surprised. I was, just for the fun of it, I was tuning to eBay.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredible how many vintage radios they have for bargains.
Oh, you're going with the Hammerlands, the Hollycrafters.
There was a Hammerland, by the way, an HQ110A.
Uh huh.
I don't know. That must have been. You have still the
180. I have the 100.
The 100?
Yeah, with the built in clock. Yeah,
yeah, okay.
It's a beauty.
That's nostalgia. But would it still be. Would you recommend it for a casual shortwave listener to tune in the extensions?
As a matter of fact, it even is SSB capable with a BFO, not a product detector. It's not a selectable sideband. They say it is, but it's a pseudo selectable sideband. If somebody's got one lying around in the basement, maybe a relative finds one in the attic, some of these vintage receivers are very, very good buys. Names to look for, like National, Hollycrafters, Collins. You might even find that was, you talk about the Rolls Royce.
ICOM.
ICOM is still an active company. And then you have, for example, Eddystone in Great Britain. RCA used to make some stuff. I mean, there's so much of this around. And if you can locate any of this equipment at a garage sale or eBay or something like that, by all means, consider it.
Japan Radio. Was the famous NRD 535.
That's a classic.
That's a
top excellent thing.
Well, you wouldn't get that for $100.
No, you wouldn't. But look at this thing, this receiver I'm talking about, a good portable that has complete coverage from 20 hertz or 50 hertz or something like that, all the way up to 30 megahertz. With different bands, you can do it analog or you can do it with digital. With a keypad, you can just put it in numeric, put it in an exact frequency. It has a BFO, so you can listen to sideband stations. It has stereo on FM, and I'm very, very surprised and very impressed by the performance of that little radio. I've seen it advertised on the internet from roughly $90 to $125, $130. Now, practically everyone can afford this these days in an industrialized country, but if we start getting into, for example, the desktops, now that you mentioned things like ICOM, you mentioned Japan Radio Company. Now, these are the serious desktop models. And there you're talking even into the thousands of dollars very easily, unless you buy it used.
Well, yes. And
I mean, I got a used ICOM. I'll tell you what I got through you, Bob. You were managing the estate of a Silent Key, a deceased radio ham, and you felt sorry for me using my Kenwood 511S ham radio transceiver. He said, why don't you look at this ICOM 735? And I got it for, what was it at the time, maybe about $450, Bob. And the thing sold for about $1,500 new. I got it for half price, and or even less. And Bob, what a receiver in there. It's true, ham radio transceivers have got fantastic, most of them general coverage receivers in there that go all the way from low, from these very low frequencies, all the way up to 30 megahertz and all the broadcasts. And I mean, when you have a ham radio transceiver, you're going to have a really semi-professional and certainly even in some cases professional quality receiver. Would you recommend that people get a transceiver instead of a receiver only for that kind of money, since the prices are not that much more expensive for a transceiver?
I'm somewhat reluctant.
Unless they're serious about becoming radio hams, right?
That's right. The reluctance goes
too much temptation
to the transmitter section of transceivers, because transceivers, the receivers, transmitters, it's both together in one box.
Yeah.
And you can press the key, and if you have an antenna resonate, you can go into the air. And so until you are a licensed radio amateur, temptation is very great.
Unless you have an iron will and you have the discipline not to push the transmit button.
Yeah. And
otherwise, let's face it, Bob, if you're a pirate radio operator, you will be found out. And you will get into an awful lot of trouble.
Yeah, and make sure you have enough money to pay the fine.
So in other words, unless you are already a radio ham or are very serious about getting your ticket, stay away from transceivers. However, the leading companies, for example, I think of Yaesu, I think of ICOM, Kenwood. These are companies, there are others, who manufacture transceivers. What they often do is take the receiver section out, put it in another box, and call it a general coverage receiver. Yeah. So you're going to get very, very good equipment from companies like that. And there are others. It's not fair to mention only a few. These are some of the best known names, but there are others. And that's why I would encourage you, for example, to get a hold of a copy of Monitoring Times. Look at their advertisers. They also have a website where you can go in and get some information about receivers. Do some research on the internet, and you will find the equipment available, and it's out there. And I would say, basically, Bob, wouldn't you agree that the more shortwave or HF specific a radio is, the better it's going to perform? I mean, if you pack too much into there, you know, AM, FM, built-in CD player and cassettes and all of this, they generally are not very serious receivers for shortwave.
No, that's, as we used to say in our show, Bob, we never try to make a racehorse out of a mule.
But you can try, but it's not going to succeed.
But as I say, ICOM has also this receiving side from a transceiver in a specific receiving box. It's the ICR8500 or the ICR75. Just look in the internet under ICOM or whatever company it comes to your head, and you'll find the market is still there. And eBay, a lot of vintage stuff which may suit your need.
Or ask around in a family, hey, do you have any old shortwave receivers? I mean, don't take any just piece of junk, because obviously advancements have been made over the decades. But there are some classics. National, we mentioned it, RCA, Hullicrafters, Hammerland. These are golden names from the past. Collins, Drake, of course. There's so many. And then, you know, Kenwood. You have older Kenwoods. You have older ICOMs. Roberts. You know, there are so many, and there's a lot of stuff. Sanjin, a Korean-made receiver. They have a lot of equipment out there today. It's amazing, the different models. So there's a lot of good stuff. You have to do a little research and ask around. Maybe also get involved in a club if you can find one, or find out, do you know anybody who's a shortwave listener or a radio ham? A radio ham is always a good place to go. They're usually more than happy to help you maybe find a source for equipment and to give you some good advice. In fact, a lot of hams may have an old piece of equipment lying around. They say, here, take it home. I can't use it anymore anyway. I've had it here for years. And you might even find yourself walking away with a piece of equipment. Bob, there's a very important thing that we want to discuss here. And that is, we raised it at the very beginning, the noise that we have today. In the past 10 years, certainly the past 15, 20 years, the amount of electronic garbage, noise, QRN, QR November, as we call it, static and all kinds of stuff, has really gone crazy. Where is it coming from?
Well, we have a lot of them are provided by the many household appliances, which are coming in big hulks these days. All the electronics contained in washing machines, in
crazy places you wouldn't imagine.
You name them.
And electric toasters, all kinds of stuff.
Of course, the fax machines.
Just take a portable radio and go up to your screen.
Yeah.
And listen, any digital display, for example, your digital alarm clock or your clock radio, digital display, just put a radio up there. Mm-hmm. Things like we've had, remember over the years, lamp dimmers, light
for
dimmers.
For instance, they make a lot of noise.
Oh, garbage, hash coming out of there. Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. And a lot of things, the chargers and power supplies for cellular phones these days. And, you know, you have to hunt these things down, go with a portable radio, an AM radio even, because most of the stuff is broadband, although not only, some of it can be on shortwave only, depends. And check your PCs, laptops, dimmer switches, so many of these things until you locate it, and chargers. When you're not charging your cell phone, pull it out of the wall. Because that stuff is coming out. I mean, it's generating. They're noise generators, Bob.
electric shaver, if they'll still use rotating collector engines, motors, hair dryers, and that's
air conditioners, for example,
yeah.
Dirty motors, this sort of thing.
Heating motors, and all that sort of thing. It clicks and clacks everywhere. That the house is full of such garbage.
And you'll notice, I mean, well, there isn't an awful lot you can do, except one of the techniques. We see this, for example, on the connector cables on computers. They have, you know, like these rings, these things they put around the ends of the cable. That's ferrite.
Ferrite cores. Huh?
Ferrite cores, which tend to absorb a lot of this radiation. You can get them in stores like Radio Shack or some of the suppliers. You can try the various kinds. Follow the instructions. And these can be very, very helpful in reducing the radiation of this equipment. A lot of people, for example, I believe, for example, in North America, the FCC, certainly the European Union has done a great deal to bring in standards and regulations that have to be followed to keep the radiation down. But there's always some rogue, maverick producer somewhere. I hear, for example, a friend of mine over in Connecticut, he's a dentist, Dennis. We have a chat every Saturday, and he was telling me he's always finding stuff. There was a whole series of electric blankets made in China that were being sold, and they were a terrific source of interference, even in violation of FCC regulations. So,
and in addition, a new one which is coming our way, Bob, this is power line communication.
This is internet over power line, big thing they're talking about,
It's a
big headache.
And you can take a wager on it. This will add to the noise as well.
And also, for example, if you have DSL, you go to your DSL modem and all of a sudden it's going, you know, the stuff that's coming through there, the buzzes. And a lot of it we just frankly can't do anything about anymore, Bob, except get that antenna outside, as you described it before, and shield the down lead so that you don't pick the stuff up on the way down as it comes into the house. And that works very, very well. For example, I have an unshielded long wire antenna I use for the low frequencies, and I'm going to have to put a piece of coax on there because I'm picking up all kinds of garbage from the internet and other sources as it comes into the shack. But my directional antenna, the Yagi, the three element, which is up on the roof and has a coaxial cable feeding it all the way down, doesn't pick the stuff up, you see. So I had one funny problem that happened, though. Very often this stuff comes from neighbors, too, when you can't do much about the neighbors. But you keep your own house clean. All of a sudden, I had a terrific noise level. And you know where I live, Bob. I mean, it's out in the country, and there was man-made noise very low out there. And all of a sudden, I started to get this S4, S5, you know, fairly moderate amount of noise, and my noise level all of a sudden went very high, and it was intermittent. It wasn't all the time. It would stay on for an hour or half an hour and then disappear again. Well, to make a long story short, two sources, my own experience. The two daughters were upstairs in their rooms, in one case using a laptop and the other one the cell phone charger. And I narrowed it down to these two sources. I said, Laureen, would you turn your PC off for a minute? All of a sudden, the noise level disappeared. The next opportunity, when Cheryl, the youngest one, was upstairs and the PC was not on, the notebook was not on, I said, Cheryl, what have you got on? Have you got any electrical you're running? They said, no. And then she said, well, I'm just charging my cell phone. I said, pull the charger out for a moment, please. All of a sudden, the noise disappeared.
Peace and quiet.
Peace and quiet prevailed. I mean, it's quite an adventure these days. But, Bob, there might be something coming over the horizon. These noises concern a modulation technique known as amplitude modulation.
Yeah.
This is the standard modulation that have been around now for, I mean, my God, it must be 75, 80 years, 100 years practically, I don't know. But there is now serious experimentation going on with what's called digital shortwave modulation. It's getting interesting for radio hams as well. At that meeting in Culpsville, every year they put on a demonstration. Kim Elliott of the Voice of America, good friend of ours, arranges this demonstration. And Bob, I have seen it. It's digital. It's clean. It's not influenced by the static or all the noise we've just been discussing. And if shortwave is going to survive in the future, and I certainly hope it does, we've discussed this on the other installment of the first discussion we had. I believe digital is the way things are going to be going, so this will go a long way to improving the quality. We're talking about FM quality over shortwave. I know there are some people who detract from it and complain that it's not everything it's claimed to be, but I was very impressed, and I think it certainly, in general, outperforms the old AM mode. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
Well, I've been looking around in the ads and find out who is producing a self-contained digital shortwave radio. And the only thing I found out was by winradio.com.
Yeah, winradio.com. They advertise in monitoring times a lot.
They seem to have something, but we have here in Europe, we have a few radio stations who, on a test basis, transmit on digital radio.
Deutsche Welle is one. For instance. I believe the BBC Merlin is doing, and Radio Netherlands is involved. And Radio France International.
A few hours.
Yeah, these are the principal players, the protagonists.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical about it, as you know, Bob. We've been talking that before. But you know as well as I do, you know our efforts we had praising high and low SRI at the times to go single sideband, negative.
No, that will never happen, Bob. You can let go of that idea.
But since people and transmitting stations have no money today, how are the chances that they will swap and switch to digital radio?
One powerful argument before we close down, I'm running out of my mini disc here. But I think the answer, the only answer that can be the strong argument, is you're going to improve your coverage, performance, quality. You can cut down the number of transmitters, and they argue you need less power to do the job. I know people like Larry Magni say it's not true, but these are strong economic arguments. You can cut down the number of expensive transmitters being operated, and maybe cut down as, the power as well. I mean, we have to wait and see. We don't have a crystal ball, Bob, but I can tell you, I've seen it, I've heard it, and it is very impressive. Bob, we've run out of time.
As usual.
Who knows? Maybe we'll be back again for another installment. But yeah. Right now, we have to say goodbye.
Yes, and well, it was nice again to chew the rag with you, Bob, again here, as we say, as hams. And maybe there will be another time before we have to close shop ourselves, but until we
do. Well, Bob, you're in great shape. I don't see any of that happening.
You never know. Things may happen so quickly, but I'm feeling all right. There's no problem about
that. Well, I'm glad we could do this, Bob.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, this is really what we did. I mean, the first installment was very much philosophy and nostalgia, reminiscence, but now we're actually doing what we did, and that is technical questions. Why don't we open this up? If this was interesting to you, as the listener, write us. Let us know if you have a particular question. Maybe you have a question we didn't cover. Now, I'm not going to promise that we're going to start up the two Bobs again. Now, that's not realistic. But who knows? If we do get a lot of response and we get some really good questions, specific questions, maybe we could come back and do a session just like we used to, Bob, just answering those questions off the top of our heads.
Yeah, especially when you say that on the Internet we have more a bigger clientele than we had on radio. So.
Well, that I won't say, because I believe it's a fair statement. At one time, Swiss Shortwave Merryground was SRI's most popular program in English. That was the truth. But let's not blow our own horns too much about it. No, we had a lot of people who liked this, and we had a nice family of friends, and they're still around. But so we've moved on. We're on the Internet right now, but the two Bobs are still here. So, I mean, if you have a question, if you have a comment about this, or you'd like us to take up something in the future, you're just a click away from the email address, contact@switzerlandinsound.com. You'll find it there. Contact@switzerlandinsound, written together, .com. And Well, we'll get a pile of questions and maybe comments, and maybe we'll sit down and do another session. Bob, who knows?
Yeah. Well, it's again made to bring the curtain down.
It certainly is, Bob, the way we always used to do it. Thank you so much for this session. It was fun. Yeah. We could have gone on for hours.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, sure. Well, friends, thank you very much for being our guests today, or our listeners, actually. And until we hear from you again, or you from us, this is Bob Tommen and
Bob Zanotti
saying goodbye.
Good DXing.
And very best of 73.